Good morning, all. Mr. Fitzpatrick?
Good morning, Your Honor. Could I ask the law clerk to come up, who are going to be admitted this morning? To my knowledge, Your Honor, this is the largest group that we've ever had admitted at the court at one time. So there's a lot of people who will be accepting appointments a few years out after they finish their clerkship.
Well, before you start, I want everyone who's to be admitted, as well as the attorneys who will be arguing the case, to be aware of the fact that Judge Rovner is with us by speakerphone. And so you're in her presence as well.
Thank
Mr. Fitzpatrick.
As I go through the names, I'm going to ask each one to step forward so that you know who that is. Catherine Agones received her undergraduate degree from the University of Rochester and her law school degree from George Washington University. Is admitted to practice in the state of Virginia and Illinois, and is a staff law clerk. Eric Beaver graduated from the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University. Eric? Thank you. Got his law school degree at DePaul and is a law clerk for Judge Caney. He's admitted to practice in the state of Indiana. Elizabeth Chiarello received her undergraduate degree and her law school degree from the University of Iowa, is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and is a staff law clerk. Gia Cobb received her undergraduate degree from Northwestern. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she is a clerk for Judge Wood, and is admitted to practice in the state of Michigan. My Angel Cody is a graduate of Xavier University in Louisiana, the Emory University School of Law, and is admitted to practice in Georgia, and is a law clerk to Judge Williams. Karen Bass Ehler received her undergraduate degree from Northwestern, her law school degree from DePaul, and she is a law clerk for Judge Bauer, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Charles Evans received his undergraduate and his law school degree from the University of Illinois, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and is a clerk for Judge Caney. Linda Friedlieb received her undergraduate degree from Stanford. Her law school degree is from the University of Chicago. She's a clerk for Judge Wood, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Eric Gortner is a law clerk for Judge Williams. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of California at Berkeley. He has a PhD from the University of Washington, and he went to Harvard for law school and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Matthew Ginsburg is a law clerk to Judge Wood, received his undergraduate degree from Wesleyan University. His law school degree is from New York University School of Law, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. David Goldman is a staff law clerk who received his undergraduate degree from the University of Florida. His law school degree is from the University of Pennsylvania, and he's admitted to practice in the state of New York. Nicole Henning is a law clerk to the Chief Judge. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her law school degree is from Yale, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Nisa Imbrock is also a law clerk to Chief Judge Flum. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Randall Jackson is a law clerk to Judge Williams. He received his undergraduate degree at Morehouse College. His law school degree is from Harvard, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Michigan and the District of Columbia. Nathan Kipp is a staff law clerk who received his undergraduate and his law school degrees from the University of Wisconsin, is admitted to practice in both the states of Wisconsin and Illinois. So you'll be taking the bar in Indiana to make it a
trifecta.
Sarah McGuire is a law clerk to Judge Cudahy. She received her undergraduate and law school degrees from the University of Wisconsin and is admitted to practice in the state of Wisconsin and in Virginia. Jeffrey Meyer is a staff law clerk who received his undergraduate degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and his law school degree was from American University Washington College of Law. He's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Christina Murdoch is a staff law clerk who received her undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago. Her law school degree is from the University of Michigan, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Steve Pizer is the clerk to Chief Judge Plum. Received his undergraduate degree from Cornell. His law school degree is from Harvard, and he's admitted to practice in New Jersey. John Scully received his undergraduate degree from Notre Dame. His law school degree is from DePaul. He's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and he's a law clerk to Judge Bauer. Tiffany Siegel received her undergraduate degree from the University of Iowa and her law school degree from Northwestern. She's a staff law clerk, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Martin Sinclair is a law clerk to Judge Bauer, who received his undergraduate degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His law school degree is from Northwestern, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Sarah Sternberg is a law clerk to Judge Cudahy. She received her undergraduate and her law school degrees from Yale and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Hannah Stotland is a law clerk to Judge Williams. She's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and she went to Harvard for her college and law school. Ann Walls is a graduate from Northeastern Illinois University, undergraduate, and DePaul Law School. She's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and she's a staff law clerk. Tiffany Walsh is a staff law clerk who received her undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago, and her law school degree is from the University of Winnipeg, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Stephanie Zimdel received her undergraduate degree from Valparaiso University and her law school degree from Northwestern. She's a law clerk to Judge Easterbrook, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Your Honors, I move. Sorry.
Diane, you didn't make it.
Okay. Sorry about that.
This is really scary. I'm Diana Swisher. I'm a staff law clerk. I went to Beloit College for undergrad, and I went to University of Michigan for law school.
And you're admitted to practice?
And I'm admitted to practice in Illinois. Please let me in.
Your Honors, I move the admission of all the above.
All right. Diane, if the circuit executive, it won't cost him his job, but the circuit executive won't vouch for you, I will. So we're you got a running start there, and we'll obviously welcome you to this class of admittees. Hearing no objection, and assuming appropriate recusals for individual clerks that work for...
How late are we able to impose objections to those?
On behalf of the court, I welcome you all to membership in the bar of the court. As you know, your service is greatly appreciated by all the judges. You come from classes in your individual schools where you've exceeded. I wish you that same success in the practice, and we look forward to continued relations this year and in the years ahead. And so we wish you nothing but the best. And Collins, you're forgiven with Diane, although whether she'll speak to you again, I'm not sure. But they'll talk. She says she'll talk to you later about it. But you generally did a good job since this was your biggest class. So we thank you all, and if you step forward and have the oath administered, we'll consider you new members of our bar.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just face the clerk.
It needs to be part of it. So funny.
The case scheduled for argument this morning is Wisconsin Community Service and Wisconsin Correctional Foundation versus the City of Milwaukee. As I informed counsel, Judge Rovner is with us by speakerphone. Mr. Smokowitz.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. The court asked us coming to this en banc argument to address four specific questions, and the parties as well as the amicus have addressed all of them directly and apparently narrowed the issues to some degree in doing so. I will, however, begin with the first question, which related to whether the two regulations cited by the court, 35130 and 4153, apply to zoning disputes. None of the parties, including the City of Milwaukee, dispute the application of 35130, at least to the general notion or the general...
So what is the legal standard you think should govern this case?
I think that the legal standard that governs this case is that set by the panel opinion. In other words, it has to be...
Well, what is it? What is your conception of it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What is it? What do you think it is, in words, not in references?
The plaintiff in this case, in order to establish a claim, must either show disparate treatment or disparate impact. The relief, then, can be an accommodation of the zoning regulations.
What do you mean by disparate impact?
By disparate impact, we do not adopt the position taken by the United States.
What do you mean by disparate impact?
By disparate impact, we mean the traditional concept of does the neutral rule have an effect that is greater and harsher on the disabled than it is on the non-disabled? And in that context, Your Honor, they would have to show statistical evidence, as they would in general, in order to establish such a claim. There is some argument by the United States to the effect of some kind of modified disparate impact analysis. We would submit that poses some dangers. There may be assumptions that judges or juries, depending upon whether that's an issue for a judge or jury, may make about whether something has an adverse impact or does not upon a disabled person.
Could you articulate what your difference is from the United States view? And the United States says that it's enough to show, and I'm quoting for its brief, that a challenged rule of practice has a greater adverse effect on the disabled person than on other individuals who do not have that disability. Now, in what respect do you disagree with that?
I disagree with that to the extent, Your Honor, that it may call for some kind of ad hoc or individual analysis. In other words, for example, they're assuming that, and there may be cases that are like this, that are quite intuitive, where if you don't have a ramp, it's going to have an adverse impact upon individuals need a wheelchair.
We're not talking about ramps. We're talking about zoning rules.
I agree, Your Honor, and that makes it even trickier in the zoning.
Well, ramps are under a different subset of the statute. Anyway.
It is under a different subset. They don't necessarily qualify it in that fashion, but even if they took to it as a general principle of zoning, there may be zoning regulations that
The reason I ask this question is that it sounds like that is a normal statement of the disparate impact standard. It bears more harshly on people in the protected class than on people who aren't in the protected class.
And to that extent, we completely agree.
So... I'm now lost. To what extent do you not agree?
Well, the panel opinion made reference to the standard, as well as the dissent making reference to the standard method of proof. And to that extent, we may disagree.
Well, I have to say I'm a bit baffled by this, too, because at least reading the brief of the United States, there was a distinction drawn between the Griggs-style disparate impact analysis, I'll just call it that for short, and the particularized disparate impact analysis the United States thinks is appropriate for Title II of the ADA, and in particular for its regulation under Title II of the ADA, since the disparate impact Griggs style tends to look at large classes. It tends to look at, you know, does a high school diploma requirement have a disparate impact on people of a certain race or the like, whereas the ADA doesn't really care if everyone in the universe except this one disabled person needs a particular accommodation. That's still enough if that is by reason of that disability, the accommodation needs to be made. So I guess I'm not sure whether you're trying to blend the Griggs style into this other thing, or whether you think there's no individualized duty on municipalities under Title II, or where you're coming from.
Well, the problem may lie in this. The United States cites no authority for its method of proof, or its suggested method of proof. And all we're trying to indicate here is that there may run into a situation where intuitively some particular situation may seem to bear more harshly on the disabled than the non-disabled. However, that may not be adequate in terms of the lack of authority for the traditional method of proof. In addition to that, if you're talking about zoning in general and you're talking about the regulations in the statute here, you're talking in general, at least the way the regulation and the statute is phrased, is policies and practices and procedures or policies or activities, not individualized instances.
But how is granting a variance any different from saying allowing the person to bring his dog in without his seeing eye dog without compliance with a quarantine rule?
Well,
in both cases, you're seeking a variance from a general rule, which is perfectly appropriate, but occasionally there's a disabled person or group that gets pinched by the rule and asks for an exception, and you balance the interests of the community against the needs of the disabled person. What's wrong with that approach?
There may be nothing wrong with that approach. It just may be the question of what the proof is that's required for it. If the court, again, the United States.
Well, surely you're not suggesting in the dog case you need statistical proof. That'd be ridiculous, right? So, wouldn't it?
I think that it would be. It may be a difficult situation, although
I don't understand you. What's difficult about it? It seems obvious.
Well,
What's difficult in the dog case? We'll start with that.
Okay. I think what Judge O'Scanlan pointed out there.
What's difficult about the dog case?
What's difficult about that case is that it's not clear that that the lack of a dog will adversely impact the disabled individual.
Really? You surprised me by saying that.
Well,
I'm blind and dependent on a seeing eye dog, I think I'm going to be in serious trouble if I have to wait 4 months to get my dog.
And that may be the particular case where some kind of proof that does not involve statistical evidence may be sufficient.
What is may be sufficient stuff? What's the problem?
The problem, again, may be that...
What's the problem in the dog case?
The problem in the dog case, the individual may be able to...
Why are you
operate effectively without the dog pending the quarantine period.
Why, how's he going to do that?
Well, if he is a blind person who has other means of getting around other than the dog, he may be able to, or she may be able to use those means.
That is to say, all blind people don't have seeing eye dogs.
That's right.
Look, isn't the difference is the person without the dog can't have access that everyone else has?
Well, everyone else doesn't have access to their dog.
No, a person with a dog can't see. And the reason that's how he's able to get around. Everyone else can go have access. He cannot have access without the dog. And I guess my question is, what is the difference with the people who want to put this clinic where it is? Who else has access that these people do not have?
Well, anyone who is who would meet the zoning criteria or the variance criteria or the special use criteria.
What other medical people? What other medical entities have access that this entity does not have?
There's no record. There's no evidence in the record that other healthcare clinics had any better or lesser.
Wait a minute. There's a healthcare clinic right across the street from the place where WCS wants.
There is, but there's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, as to whether that was grandfathered in, provided a variance, or whether the zoning regulation was changed.
They have better access, though. They're there.
Again, that may not be the product of a zoning decision. It may be a product of a historical antecedent. There's no evidence in the record, in other words, Your Honor, that they sought a variance and obtained the variance, or they sought a special use permit and obtained the special use permit. That's the zoning decision, I believe, that's at issue here. It's not the question of whether the zoning policy of the city of Milwaukee is somehow defective. I mean, Mr. Platel or WCS hasn't made that contention to the best of our knowledge.
Mr. Smokowitz, forgive me. This is Judge Rovner. I'm just wondering, you know, you argued that the requested permit isn't a reasonable accommodation because there's another property that was available. I am wondering if you are arguing that an accommodation is never reasonable unless it is the only alternative available.
We are not, Your Honor, but it doesn't necessarily make it reasonable just because another property is available. I think this Court's rejected that already. I think
but why isn't that like the dog case? You say, well, maybe there are, or Judge Barr said, maybe there are alternatives to a dog to get around if you're blind. But what if there isn't an alternative? So what if for these mentally ill people, they need the variance because their present facility is too crowded and that is very disorienting for these mentally ill people. So if you set aside the other property, that $4 million property, and they have no alternative at all, are you still arguing that there's no duty to grant the variance?
No, Your Honor. We're just simply arguing that accommodation issue doesn't come into the case until after the showing of disparate treatment or disparate impact.
Well, I don't understand you because it's just like the dog case, right? You have a general zoning rule which forbids dogs, or in this case forbids this mental health facility. So don't you have to consider the alternatives that the mentally ill people would have, just as you'd consider the alternative that the blind person has?
The analogy doesn't hold up because we don't generally prohibit mental health clinics in the city of Milwaukee. The quarantine is for the entire state of Hawaii for all dogs, as I understand it. The problem here is that...
Wait a second. You don't prohibit what?
We don't. There are many zoning areas in the city of Milwaukee for which this clinic would be properly zoned. It's not like the quarantine case. The person who wants...
No, that's the question. Are there alternatives? Yeah. Right? That's the that's a factual question.
But that's more than that. It's a distinguishing legal or the distinguishing factual element that leads to the legal problem here. In other words, in the dog case, if you assume some kind of difference of treatment or some kind of difference of impact, and I think that's where they really are there in that case, is a difference of impact between the disabled and the non-disabled, then you can get to the question of whether they have to make an accommodation to the rule based upon whatever evidence you've shown for disparate impact. Here, the problem is that they haven't made a showing of disparate treatment or disparate impact. And so you don't get to the question of whether that evidence is A, sufficient for that showing of either of those, or B, whether the accommodation that's been requested is reasonable until you get to the first hurdle.
Could I ask you just a procedural question. The district court judge relied on the record that was made before the Board of Zoning Appeals. I don't know whether you actually refer to it as BOZA or not, but the board in the two phases. And you're content to stand on that record, or do you think that record somehow is insufficient?
I think that for the issues of disparate impact, if there has to be statistical evidence, it would have to be broader than the record itself. For the issue of disparate treatment, that would also have to be broader. Beyond that, I don't know whether there would be need for additional evidence to be taken in the case.
Well, the reason I'm interested is because in this record, at least, there's a lot of evidence about the efforts of WCS to find an alternative place, and it's done at all, what I'll think of as a pragmatic level. Maybe the map of the city of Milwaukee shows areas zoned for mental health clinics, but if nothing was on the market that was going to meet the criteria, you can't just sort of, you don't have eminent domain power, of course, as a private entity. You can only be able to buy what you can buy. And so on this record, it looks like there were really only two places, the $4 million place that was too expensive and the place that they bought. So you're saying, well, hypothetically, maybe there were other places, but why should we deal in hypotheticals?
Well, I don't think you have to deal with a hypothetical. I don't believe that the alternative that the city produced in time for the remanded Board of Zoning Appeals hearing was out of their price range.
Well, that's the right. I remember your argument.
It was a couple $1 million as opposed to $4 million at that point.
One broker said it could have been got at 2.2.
Right.
There's no evidence that the seller was willing to do that. It was what the broker said. So hearsay in that respect. But I want to get back to just to finalize something about this dog thing. Is it your position that if one blind person needs a dog, but another blind person happens to be wealthy enough to hire a full-time assistant, so they don't really care about the dog regulation, there's no duty under the ADA to accommodate the person who needs the dog? I'm trying to suggest something where the class of even blind people as a whole isn't a homogenous group, and some need the dog. So do you think all of them have to need the dog for the accommodation duty to be there, or just even one individual?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that that's necessarily an issue that has to be addressed here. If the court feels that the parties need guidance on what evidence needs to be adduced for disparate impact, it may be an issue.
Well, the reason I think it may be here, just to, you may be right, but is that we're focusing on this particular mental health clinic and what they did. And if it's the focus on this particular clinic and what the impact of the zoning regulations and the refusal to give the special use permit was on them, that might be one thing versus the kind of global look. That's what I'm thinking.
And I think the answer to the question, again, is that to our best of our ability, we've seen nothing to substantiate the United States' position of this sort of ad hoc, disparate impact kind of analysis. The court may wish to adopt that because it may feel that that's appropriate under this statute.
I don't understand what your answer to her question is, though. In the dog case, does the case fail because, as Judge Wood said, there might be a wealthy person who could substitute a human being for the seeing eye dog?
I think there'd have to be more evidence than that, but limit me to that hypothetical, Your
Excuse
Honor, I think
me?
It should not fail.
Should not fail.
It should not fail. The question may be, however, whether if you look broader, if you look in the general statistical pool, and you're not focused just on
what that's. I don't know what you're talking about.
If you look
statistical pool, you mean how many people can afford a seeing eye person instead of a seeing eye dog?
How many people have alternative means of getting around?
You seem to be treating this as if we were just going to make something up. But as I understand the normal principles of administrative law, an agency's interpretation of its own regulation is conclusive unless they've utterly taken leave of their senses. And it's clear that the Department of Justice views this regulation as one that's person-specific and does not require statistical evidence or evidence about larger groups. Now, why don't we take, per normal principles of administrative law, the view of the regulation advanced by its author?
The backstop always has to be the language and interpretation of the courts of the statute. And if it's not consistent with earlier interpretation of what is necessary to show disparate impact under the statute, whether the United States suggests, as it does in this case without any particular citation to authority, an analysis of the disparate impact, I would submit, may or may is not entitled to that degree of deference.
Mr. Smugowitz, this is Judge Rovner again. Did you present any evidence in district court or any expert evidence rebutting the WCS evidence that the clinic overcrowding aggravated the client's mental disabilities and diminished the clinic's ability to provide services? And if the answer to that is yes, I'd appreciate your identifying that evidence with some specificity.
Your Honor, we presented no competing evidence in that regard. There was simply a credibility determination that was made by the Board of Zoning Appeals based upon what it heard as evidence. And the lack in it concluded that the evidence that had been submitted by WCS in that regard was insufficient to demonstrate that the requested accommodation would have such an effect, ameliorative effect, for its client patients.
I wanted you to clarify something regarding the permit and its use and whether, in your view, the special use permit runs with the use rather than the land. And if so, would WCS gain an economic advantage by being able to sell the building with its special zoning, or would the special use permit expire with the change in ownership?
I believe it expires, Your Honor. You're asking me a zoning issue that is a little bit beyond my expertise, I'm afraid. But I believe the answer to your question, Your Honor, is that the use would expire upon the sale of it. In fact, the Board of Zoning Appeals will sometimes grant special use permits, and I believe may have done so in this case pursuant to the district court's order, that continued to have some conditions in it. And, of course, a violation of that condition would also bring an end to the special use permit. And so that's the basis for my concluding that that the special use permit can be does not run with the land. Now, getting back to what Judge Wood asked before about in terms of the adjoining or the nearby property, I don't know whether that's a special use permit for that particular clinic or whether zoning areas were redrawn at some point after that property went in there. And the city, in redrawing the area, changed the zoning classification for this particular area, but because of the effect of grandfathering, they can't take away their property rights at that point, and they're permitted to be there. Under Wisconsin law, as I understand it, once they would leave the premises, they too would that exception would also go away.
What are the different classifications, if any, of health clinics in Milwaukee under its
I don't think there is any general.
All right, so there's one classification. It's health clinics or medical clinics. So if the clinic that's across the street were to take on another function and start servicing clients that are presently treated by WCS, that would not would be permitted. So if one of the things in these accommodations is the hardship on the in this case, the city, it's just hard for me to see that there's a real problem here if the same clients can be serviced across the street right now. Why would that be a hardship for the city to have them serviced on the other side of Wisconsin Avenue?
Well, you get into the kind of difficult or amorphous issue of whether eroding zoning areas is a hardship to a municipality or not. In other words, the city has created the zoning area there. If you chip away with one property, you can chip away with another, and you can chip away with another, and eventually the entire zoning area has changed. And so the hardship to the municipality.
But it's zoned commercial already, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what if it becomes a magnet for medical facilities? Why would that be bad? Cities like that, you know, that's.
Well,
right, there's one there. Now, if this zoning variance were granted, there'd be another. Maybe that would, you know, there are these economies of scale and having similar facilities together. So I'm really just pursuing Judge Evans' question. What really is the hardship to the city that you want to balance against the hardships to the metal?
Again, the only hardship that I can point to is the fact that if you begin the process of moving in that direction. You change that into
No, I understand that, for example, where you have lot size in residence, you know, like the Hemisphere case. But I don't see the problem here. Zone commercial, suppose, you know, you have more and more medical facilities congregating there. Why is that hard? Are medical uses
I don't think they're disfavored, Your Honor. I just think simply that the city's made a decision about certain areas where it wants to have or wants to encourage
businesses
and not others. And it's made that distinction between commercial and medical clinics. And it may be a good distinction or it may be one that may not be intuitive.
Well, wait a second. If it's not good, I don't see how it balances the hardship of the mentally ill.
Well,
it seems to me you have to argue that there's some, you know, solid benefit from maintaining somehow the character of this area and not having a medical facility.
It could be very much, for example, that the commercial uses...
It could be. Is there some evidence?
I can only say this, Your Honor. I assume that the city made that distinction because it felt that
uses
are not...
You assume? So on one side, we have the uncontradicted evidence that these mentally ill people are harmed by this crowding. On the other hand, we have assumptions and speculations.
Well, that was not something that was put into evidence in this case, Your Honor, but...
Well, if it wasn't put into evidence, I don't think it's going to help you here.
Typically, cities make that distinction because they believe the two uses are inconsistent.
Typically, assumptions, speculation, but no evidence.
Well, here's a question without any with a lot of speculation. If this clinic was... servicing breast cancer patients, it's hard for me to see that the city would object to it in this commercially zoned area across the street from an already permissible use for that sort of activity.
Again, it may be a problem that the city has with combining the two uses. They may see them as inconsistent either because they potentially present a harm to the medical clinic patients or because they just simply see that the two uses do not provide...
Well, you're making this sound like a rational basis test. It may be, we can posit reasons for this. Is that the way we're supposed to...
No, Your Honor. I mean, I'm trying to directly address the question. I think the only answer that I can give you in terms of what interest is harmed by the city is that it has an interest in
zoning. Well,
is there evidence
of that? Is just the general interest in zoning?
That's correct, Your Honor.
When you say that zoning cases are almost invariably involve arbitrary decisions made by boards, there you are.
Well, there is a certain degree of arbitrariness in these decisions. Yeah.
We decided this is going to be residential, this is going to be single family, this is going to be multiple, this is going to be commercial, this is going to be that kind of commercial, this is going to have taverns and this one won't. And those are arbitrary decisions made by the municipal authorities. All you're doing is representing the municipal authorities who made arbitrary decisions.
Then the question is, how do those arbitrary decisions interact with a federal statute like Title II of the ADA?
Which is an arbitrary decision of itself.
Which is its own which is its own law, however. Last I checked, there was a supremacy clause.
Your Honor, I don't think that I would want to diminish all municipal zoning decisions to the point of just simply being arbitrary. I think that there are decisions that are made in terms of inconsistency of uses. Heavy industrial, let's say, for example, versus... residential. I think that
city of Milwaukee is certainly entitled not to look like Houston. I don't disagree with that.
Reading into your rebuttal.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smokowitz. Mr. Pled.